Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part 3 of our series, The Matrix, A Further Exploration. We'll take a look at new techniques of social control. I hope you'll stay tuned. The movie The Matrix was a hit when it was released in 1999. The main theme here was illusion versus reality. The world, as most people experienced it, was shown to be an artificially constructed fantasy. The real world was much more horrible. The film went a step beyond Plato's cave allegory. In the cave, the shadows that people mistook for reality at least resembled reality. In the movie, the false reality, that is, the Matrix, had almost no connection to the real reality. In 2000, essayist Richard K. Moore saw the Matrix as the perfect metaphor to describe the propaganda image disguising the actual foreign, domestic, and economic policies of the world's capitalist ruling elite. Lynn Gurry read aloud his essay, Escaping the Matrix, on her show Unwelcome Guests. Now Robin Upton has woven together Lynn's reading with selections from other installments of Unwelcome Guests. New World Notes is broadcasting this fine collage over several weeks. Today, in part 3, as cracks in the Matrix illusion appeared, and people began disbelieving the propaganda, new methods of social control were devised to keep us in line. These included new weapons, the militarization of the police forces, creating a prison industrial complex, and, sine qua non, neutralizing the Bill of Rights. Increasing surveillance of everybody, that's a more recent addition to our ruler's toolkit that the essay doesn't mention, but we can add it to the list. This installment ends by discussing a particularly nasty technique of social control, promoting narcotics use in our urban ghettos. We'll hear the voices of two key figures in exposing the government's inner-city narcotics operation: police whistleblower Mike Rupert and investigative reporter Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News. But we begin with new non-lethal weapons designed to stop protesters from protesting.
The management of discontented societies. The post-war years, especially in the United States, were characterized by consensus politics. Most people shared a common understanding of how society worked and generally approved of how things were going. Prosperity was real, and the Matrix version of reality was reassuring. Most people believed in it. Those beliefs became a shared consensus, and the government could then carry out its plans as intended, responding to the programmed public will. The excess democracy of the 1960s and 1970s attacked this shared consensus from below, and neoliberal planners decided from above that ongoing consensus wasn't worth paying for. They accepted that segments of society would persist in disbelieving various parts of the Matrix. Activism and protest were to be expected. New means of social control would be needed to deal with activist movements and with growing discontent.
618.
What we're looking at here in general is a dialectic between the military and corporate elite consolidated in the interests of maintaining the capitalist ship of state, so to speak, maintaining the profits and privileges of the elite in this country against the great majority of the American people. So you have Pentagon, Congressional, in lockstep around this whole question of militarization of law enforcement. The Council on Foreign Relations, an elite policymaker, headquartered in New York City, in 1995, the Independent Task Force on Non-Lethal Weapons of the Council on Foreign Relations issued a report which stressed the need to assess the current status of non-lethal weapons development, advocating the increased and research and development at the Pentagon in the area of so-called non-lethal weapons, which are weapons designed to suppress dissent, suppress civilian protest, and so forth.
Who was its director, and what was he well known for?
The director of the CFR task force was a gentleman by the name of W. Montague Winfield. Brigadier General Winfield was, along with chairing this independent task force on non-lethal weapons, was the deputy director for operations in the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11. He was the person who, according to the 9/11 Commission, left his very important post at the National Military Command Center. Remember, there was this whole story about this lack of communication and the pilots didn't know where they were going and it's all this chaos. Well, he's the guy who left his post that very morning to attend a so-called pre-scheduled meeting and allowed a colleague who had only recently qualified to take over his position and standing in for him. And he didn't return to his post until after the so-called attacks had ended. There you have another example of this close collaborative relationship between the military and the Pentagon, not only in the area of non-lethal weapons, but as pointed out here in the machinations of 9/11.
New means of social control would be needed to deal with activist movements and with growing discontent, as neoliberalism gradually tightened the economic screws. Such means of control were identified and have since been largely implemented, particularly in the United States.
What is the May 17, 2012 Department of Defense Instruction 3200.19 entitled Non-Lethal Weapons Human Effects Characterization?
Basically, what it does is it attempts to scientifically calibrate levels and quotients of pain and suffering.
In many ways, America sets the pace of globalization. Innovations can often be observed there before they occur elsewhere. This is particularly true in the case of social control techniques. The most obvious means of social control in a discontented society is a strong, semi-militarized police force. Most of the periphery had been managed by such means for centuries. This was obvious to elite planners in the West, was adopted as policy, and has now been largely implemented. Urban and suburban ghettos, where the adverse consequences of neoliberalism are currently most concentrated, have literally become occupied territories, where police beatings and unjustified shootings are commonplace. So that the beefed-up police force could maintain control in conditions of mass unrest, elite planners also realized that much of the Bill of Rights would need to be neutralized. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government.
When Jefferson and Madison were putting together the Bill of Rights, what they wanted to do was build an absolute wall between government, which could live forever and could accumulate power and could potentially one day oppress its citizens because they had just overthrown such a government, between government on the one hand and the rights of individual citizens on the other hand. So they wanted to give this enormous club to the citizens so that they could beat back government if it ever became oppressive. And that club is the right of assembly, the right of free speech, the right not to incriminate yourself, the right to a trial by your peers, the right to privacy, and you know, the right against discrimination, which was passed after the Civil War, and what we call the Bill of Rights, you know, and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
Let me say that again. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government. The rights neutralization project has been largely implemented. as exemplified by armed midnight raids, outrageous search and seizure practices, overly broad conspiracy laws, wholesale invasion of privacy, massive incarceration, and the rise of prison slave labor.
16.
To quote from a Corrections Corporation of America business prospectus sent over the Internet in January 1999, prison-based industry offers several advantages, including a plentiful labor force, low operating costs, and available space. The plentiful labor force, or as some corporate executives are calling them, raw materials, are the increasing numbers of men and women transferred into the private prisons. The low operating costs are the literal slave wage pennies paid to the labor force, the inmates. Giant corporations like IBM, Nike, and Wilson Sporting Goods are beginning to see the benefits of private prison industrialization. Many such companies are starting to relocate manufacturing plants out of third world nations and placing them into private prisons around the country. Once there, these corporations can legally pay the labor force anywhere from 17 cents to $1.25 per hour to make their products. They also reduce their costs of overseas shipping. As Oregon State Representative Kevin Mannix said to Nike officials when encouraging them to relocate production from Indonesia to his home state, "Take a look at the transportation and labor costs. We can offer competitive prison labor here."
The Rubicon has been crossed. The techniques of oppression long common in the empire's periphery are being imported to the core.
672.
The organization which says, for example, how many automatic machine guns, how many automatic weapons the police are going to have, or whether they're going to use tasers, or whether they're going to use shotgun tasers, all those policy decisions are being made by ACPO.
ACPO level.
And ACPO is a private company.
Mm-hmm.
And we've learned earlier in the program that we have another private company called Kroll that's able to exert extraordinary influence over our police force.
And their chairman is here advising the Home Office as we speak now on policing matters.
In The Matrix, the genre of the TV or movie police drama has served to create a reality in which rights are a joke, the accused are despicable sociopaths, and no criminal is ever brought to justice until some noble cop or prosecutor bends the rules a bit. Government officials bolster the construct by declaring wars on crime and drugs. And noble cops are fighting a war out there in the streets. And you can't win a war without using your enemy's dirty tricks. The CIA plays its role by managing the international drug trade and making sure that ghetto drug dealers are well supplied.
Yes, I am alleging that the CIA is involved in high-level drug trafficking. You may ask yourself why, then, in Wikipedia, does their page only refer to allegations of CIA drug trafficking? Let's hear from LAPD narcotics investigator turned whistleblower Mike Rupert speaking in episode 23.
Gary Webb's fabulous book, Dark Alliance, goes further than any other toward really documenting direct CIA involvement. Well, a number of investigations were started as a result of that, and as a result of my confrontation with John Deutsch. Now, these are excerpts which I publish. But the report from which these excerpts come is a CIA report. And I have a huge website, and those of you who want to write it down, it's www.copvcia.com, C-O-P-V-C-I-A.com. And you can link directly to the CIA report, which is about 460 pages. But I have pulled these 60 pages out of that report, and I've made my editorial comments, but these are the CIA's own words. In their report, which was released on October the 8th of 1998, the CIA admits that it, throughout the course of the Contra War, it dealt with 58 known narcotics traffickers. It admits that it kept six of them out of jail. It admits that it deliberately lied to the United States Congress about the role of drug trafficking played by its assets and employees during the Contra War. It admits that it briefed Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush on how it was lying to Congress about trafficking by its agents and employees and assets on a regular basis, and that Vice President Bush approved. It admits page after page after page, but let me just read you one little example okay, when we talk about proof. Paragraph 490 talks about a guy named Moises Nunez, okay? He was a CIA contractor, in essence. He was on a State Department subsidy. The poor guy wasn't making enough moving 200 kilos of cocaine a week, so the State Department had to give him a little extra to supply humanitarian aid to the Contras. And he was caught with 200 kilos of cocaine and taken into custody, and the CIA talked to him, and they wrote here, he says that Nunez revealed that since 1985 he had engaged in a clandestine relationship with the National Security Council. That's the White House that oversees the CIA. That's Oliver North, okay? He had engaged in a clandestine relationship with the National Security Council. Nunez refused to elaborate on the nature of these actions, but indicated it was difficult to answer questions relating to his involvement in narcotics trafficking because of the specific tasks he had performed at the direction of the NSC. In other words, he's dealing the cocaine for the White House. It's right here, CIA's own report. Okay? In the next paragraph, CIA says, well, we didn't know what to do with this guy, but it says, the next day, however, a headquarters cable stated that headquarters had decided against debriefing Nunez. Don't ask him any more questions. Direct cable from CIA to the field. Page after page. A company called Setco, moving 4 tons of cocaine a month, owned by Juan Ramon Mara Ballesteros in Honduras, was using bank accounts that were opened by Oliver North. It's right here in the CIA's report. Now, let me read you the most stunning part of this. This is the actual letter. It's a memorandum. In 1981, Ronald Reagan's director of Central Intelligence and the U.S. Department of Justice began a series of negotiations because it's a law under U.S. code that a government agency must report crimes by its employees. But yet they started a whole new series of negotiations under Reagan, and they suddenly took, at CIA, the highest level on the food chain is a case officer. That's a card-carrying, badge-carrying CIA guy who can't be disavowed if he's caught or captured. Beneath that, they have career agents, they have contract agents, they have informants, they have contract employees, they have all these other things. And they entered into this negotiations, and they suddenly said everybody who's not a case officer at CIA is no longer an employee under the law. These are people who were going to get pensions from CIA. Let me read you this letter dated, just one paragraph, dated February 11th, 1982. It's addressed to the Honorable William J. Casey, Director of Central Intelligence, signed by William French Smith, Ronald Reagan's Attorney General. It says, in light of these provisions and in view of the fine cooperation the Drug Enforcement Administration, Shelley may comment on that, has received from CIA, no formal requirement regarding the reporting of narcotics violations has been included in these procedures. By the stroke of a pen, this is the smoking gun document, the U.S. Department of Justice told the CIA that there was no need to report drug trafficking by its employees. Now, if I say to you that we have a criminal government, maybe I will make some sense to you. I hope so. It's clear. It's as clear as the nose on my face. It's as clear as the nose on everybody's face right here, okay? We have a criminal government that is engaged in criminal activity. Why do we act sometimes as if we're dealing with someone that has perfect legitimacy, but we have to work within the system?
I think that's a very important question by Mike Rupert, and one that bears further reflection upon. I think it was Martin Luther King said something approximating to the sentiment that people do not easily speak out against their government. He was criticizing the Vietnam War, and he felt that, on his part, silence would be betrayal, that he had to speak out. I think increasingly many people are actually following that, not because they are crazy, more because it's increasingly well understood in the 21st century. Citizens, compared to before, have an ever wider ability to share information with others and to discuss things through the internet, and the understanding that mendacity at the highest levels, far from being the result of bad apples, has become absolutely routine, that is forcing people to speak out. I'm going to suggest that cooperating with a system which is hard at work destroying the biosphere, cutting down trees, pulling fish out of the oceans, poisoning the environment, is not something that we should do lightly, and that there are certainly alternatives, and, well, that's one reason why I'm making this audio, to try and share my opinions, to give them a wider audience, because I'm sick and tired of the lies that are peddled through corporate media. Some more thanks are in order to the good people at GNN, that's Guerrilla News Network, who made and put online the following interview with Gary Webb, which I saw way back when and helped me to see the bigger picture that, yes, the CIA were dealing drugs, and of course, all that money helped them cover it up. And this is something we broadcast in episode 592.
Investigative reporting is being sort of squeezed out of the picture, and I think intentionally, because it tends to ruffle feathers. I mean, good investigative reporting does ruffle feathers, and it draws lawsuits, and it gets newspapers in trouble.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ship.
My name's Gary Webb. I am an investigative journalist. I've been an investigative journalist for about 25 years for daily newspapers. And in 1996, I wrote a series of stories entitled Dark Alliance, which was about CIA involvement in drug trafficking. What my story showed was that the cocaine that was being sold in those neighborhoods was coming from mainly one source, and this one source was being used to finance a guerrilla war in Central America. The general idea of the CIA dealing drugs was something that the American mainstream press had never written about before, and that's why it prompted outrage among blacks, among drug reform activists, among politicians, by the CIA, by every federal agency involved in the drug war, because it showed they weren't doing their jobs, that it was a fraud. Right after we published the stories, the support we got from the media was very favorable. Newsweek magazine did a big piece on the story and said it was well documented and well researched. The website was getting like a million hits a day. There were marches in Watts, there were marches in Compton, there were candlelight vigils. Every California senator demanded an official investigation. So the story itself was really building momentum. The government reaction was no reaction. And this, I believe, was a very careful strategy, because nobody was going to believe the government if they came out and said we didn't do it. The proof was fairly overwhelming, since we had all these government documents showing that it had happened. So what happened was they let the so-called liberal press speak for them. And they had the national security reporters at the Washington Post, who coincidentally used to work for the CIA, write stories saying it doesn't mean anything. It was a distraction from what the story said, and it became sort of a media war between the Mercury News, which stood behind the story at that point, and the rest of the establishment media, who wanted us to back away from it. And part of that reason was because these major newspapers had written about this issue back in the 1980s, but had written about it very dismissively, as if this is nonsense, it doesn't happen, it never happened. And then 10 years later, we came back with documentation showing that it was absolutely true and that it was worse than we were. We had gotten a story out around them, and we had gotten it out in a big way that they couldn't control, and that was through the internet. And I think a lot of this was directed to the Mercury News to say, we don't care what documentation you have, we don't care what kind of story you've got, we set the national news agenda. And if we don't like your story, we will kill your story, regardless of its truth. The media rejoiced when this came out, because it meant they had won. They had forced a newspaper to back away from a story that was true, simply because of this barrage of criticism, of mindless criticism, essentially, that really took its toll on the editors of the newspaper. And they were they were being seen as sort of outcasts from the club. And I think they made a political decision that it was better in the long run to take a dive on this story and get back in the good graces of the rest of the media. It was essentially a war between my editors and myself, because I wouldn't apologize for the story or back away from the story, and fought them on it publicly. And so they transferred me to a bureau that was 140 miles from where I lived, and I called in sick a lot. One of the things I'm proudest of in regards to that story is the website that the Mercury News set up, because it really was the first time that a newspaper brought its readers not only into the interior of the paper, but into the reporters' notebooks. You know, this was a story that, as I told my editors, had a very high unbelievability factor built into it. A lot of people were going to say, this can't be true. And this story became a sensation because of the website, not because of the story, but because people could get to it. And they could never have gotten to it before, because the San Jose Mercury News is a small regional newspaper in Northern California that you couldn't read if you lived in New York, or you couldn't read if you lived in LA. But this story you could read anywhere in the world and see all of our documentation. So it became, and we did this on purpose, to make it very hard to knock down, to make it very difficult for people to say this didn't happen. But they said it didn't happen anyway.
The CIA plays its role by managing the international drug trade and making sure that ghetto drug dealers are well supplied. In this way, the American public has been led to accept the means of its own suppression. The mechanisms of the police state are in place. They will be used when necessary, as we see in ghettos and skyrocketing prison populations, as we saw on the streets of Seattle and Washington, D.C. during recent anti-WTO demonstrations, and as is suggested by executive orders that enable the president to suspend the Constitution and declare martial law whenever he deems it necessary.
And here we must end part three of our series, The Matrix, a Further Exploration. More to come in the future. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. For more of Unwelcome Guests, try unwelcomeguests.net. Hail and farewell, illegitimi non carborundum, and please tune in again next week. See ya.